You've been searching for the best way to generate passive income in your life and heard that real estate is a great way to do it. But you're tired of all the so-called gurus who are all talk and no substance. Get ready to celebrate because Kevin Buck has spent 14 years successfully making it happen. This is the Real Estate Investing for Cash Flow podcast. Now, here's Kevin Buck.
Hey guys, Kevin Bupp here, and I want to welcome you to another episode of the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. Our mission is to help you build and maintain massive amounts of cash flow through income-producing real estate investments. And our guest for this week's show is real estate investment expert, Kavitha Barataki. Now, Kavitha is the founder of Cherry Street Investments, an Austin-based firm that focuses on multifamily, build-to-rent, and senior care facilities. Now, prior to real estate, she spent almost 20 years as a technology professional, working for IBM in various roles across software development, customer services, partner relations, and technical account management. And so with that, guys, it's my honor to welcome Kavitha to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Kevin. Thanks for having me here.
Excited to have you. I know we were chatting a little bit before we started recording here about all the great things you have working. It seems like you got your hands in a lot of different projects, exciting projects that run the gamut across the board of many different asset classes, all the way, from existing product down to, land entitlement. So we're going to, have some fun conversation today talking about you, your business, and all the, again, exciting things you have working. But maybe before we get rolling here, for those that aren't familiar with you, I'm going to pass the mic back to you. And if you could take a few moments to just tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, and, fill in some of those gaps that I left there in the bio.
Sure. Yeah, I came to the U.S. in 98 as a grad student, went to Texas A&M, graduated, did all the usual things that people, most Indians do. And I'm kind of like, oh, are you in IT is the first question that people ask when you're an Indian, which I didn't fall too far from that profile. I did what every Indian is supposed to do. But I think this is where I took my career, took a turn from going from IT after, working for big companies and corporate world to doing real estate. I started doing single family homes like everybody else, but then learned about multifamily, was super interested actually seeking multifamily for a long time, and then finally found a group out of Dallas, joined them, started learning, mostly did only passive investments because I was really busy with my corporate job, and had kind of financially freed myself along the way just with my single family homes. So I think I went to that pivotal point where I'm like, do I really want to do what I'm doing in tech? And the answer was no. So I just got up one day and I said, actually had a disagreement with my manager or something. And I just quit, sent her a Slack message saying, I'm out. And she's like, are you serious? I'm like, yeah, I've just been waiting for the right time. So today's as good as a day as any. And yeah, and then started Cherry Street about 6 months before I quit actually. But it was just mostly, initially when I started, I was just working with another sponsor as a co-GP in the first project. So literally had one project under my belt when I quit, not a whole lot of things going on. So it's sort of been an evolution since then. I'm learning about other asset classes. I am engaging with partners who have a lot of experience in that field. So it's made the transition a lot smoother, and I really kind of enjoy the capital side of things, dealing with investors, dealing with communications to investors, and long-term building a relationship with my investors.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I appreciate that. And I guess, additional question would be, what was the original catalyst that pushed you towards real estate? I mean, obviously you're working a corporate gig, looking to put your hard-earned money and capital into some type of investment, but why real estate? What ultimately had you go down that road?
I think a couple of things. Primarily, 2008 happened, and I saw my 401k kind of going into half, pretty much. And I also got a divorce about the same time. So both of that literally went from half to quarter after the divorce too. So it was just a combination of that. And then I started trading options, stock options. Mm-hmm. And so I made a lot of money and I lost a lot of money. And It was far from being passive, and I was spending so much time in front of the computer, I didn't want to take lunch. And at that point, I was like, okay, this cannot be the way to make money. There's got to be a better way. And all around me, there were foreclosures. So I'm like, why not that? Right. So it was my first home that I bought. As I got more confident about handling tenants, I bought more. And as I got more money and I started doing all this BRRR strategy, which I didn't even know at that time. I just didn't have a name for it. I just said, there's equity there. The market's gone up. I need to tap into the equity and buy another one. So
you basically got in when the prices were really, really good. So was that back in 2009, 2010 that you were buying those foreclosures, or I guess?
Correct. I started in 2009.
Okay.
And I bought them all the way through 15. And I think 15, I felt like a little jittery.
It couldn't go any higher, right?
Like, how can it keep going up? 7-year cycle is kind of ringing in my head, right?
Yeah.
Typically we see 7-year cycles. So I started getting really careful around 15, 16. And then I started looking at multifamily around that time.
Yeah. Well, yeah, fantastic time to purchase anything. You know, in hindsight, we chatted about this before the call, but in hindsight, we would have bought everything that came across our desk if we would have known the cycle would have lasted as long as it's lasted, right? But next time around, I guess, next time around. So multifamily was the first foray, but I know, again, you know, chatting about it briefly, you've got your hands in many different pots, so lots of different exciting projects. I know one that we were chatting about, actually two that we were chatting about, two build to rent projects. You've also got some senior facilities, senior housing, and senior care facilities, and also land entitlement, which is really exciting. Again, it's probably a topic that a lot of folks just don't know about. It's when you talk about niches, I mean, that is a much smaller, less known niche than that of your typical multifamily investor, or even, you know, senior care, or, you know, some of the other ones. So maybe let's talk about outside of the multifamily, some of these other projects, but more specifically, you know, the attraction to diversify outside of multifamily to these other asset classes.
So I think it kind of sparked off a little bit during COVID, because I was personally only in multifamily before COVID. And I think part of it was realizing that, okay, every sponsor who had, including us, including me, we stopped distributing during COVID just to conserve reserves and, you know, just got a little bit tighter. And I'll take that back. I had invested in ATMs before COVID. And interestingly, what I found is during COVID, pretty much all my sources of passive income kind of dried up, or at least were put on hold. And then I realized, oh my God, I'm so not undiversified from my own profile portfolio standpoint that I literally wasn't in the stock market anymore because I had pulled out over a period of time. I had some crypto, not much to speak about, and then mostly in multifamily and single families. Single families, I decided I needed to be more conservative because we don't know which tenant wouldn't pay or how many tenants couldn't pay and when things would go wrong. So the only cash flow I had at that time was ATM investments. Mm-hmm. So I realized for myself that, hey, from an investor standpoint, I have these investors that I'm placing into multifamily deals, but how is it going to serve them, one, when, say, I had someone who was retiring based on their passive income? I mean, like, sorry, no retirement income for you anymore. It's COVID time, no income for you. So that wasn't an acceptable solution for me, for my investors, and for myself as well. So I started looking into investing into others. Like I said, ATM was one of them, which was still paying out. So I invested my own money into, I started diversifying for myself. And one of the other reasons was I felt like, okay, multifamily, as things came back up, the cap rates have compressed further since COVID, right? And it's really becoming lean and hard to cash flow in multifamily. I don't know what, depend. Maybe if you go to a tertiary market, there's still some cash flow, but primary markets, if you push out a 7%, it's a hard day, right? Unless you're buying a lot of value add, and you're able to add value fairly quickly and push up the cap rates within, let's say, a year or two.
Yeah.
So I started thinking about it as, okay, a lot of my investors don't necessarily care about cash flow, which is true. I do want to keep investing in multifamily or even figure out other assets. That's where senior living came in. I started seeing that senior living had much better cash flows overall. So that would be a cash flow asset. But I'm thinking from an equity growth standpoint, what delivers a bang for my buck? So I have a lot of investors who have incomes, they have multiple jobs, like both people in their household are employed. They don't care about cash flow as much as the velocity of their money, right? Mm-hmm. So that's when land kind of came into my wheelhouse. And I met a land partner, incidentally, that I wanted to invest with. And we started talking a little bit more. And the more I understood this whole concept of entitlement, because I'm not one of those, it's like, hey, let me hope and buy this land and pray that it goes up. That doesn't work for me. That's not a strategy that I believe in. I don't believe in true banking in the sense that just hold and wait and see. To me, that's too open-ended. Mm-hmm. But then when I found out about this whole entitlement play, it made a lot of sense to me, because now you're taking a raw piece of land and actually adding value to it, just like you would add value to an apartment building.
Yeah.
Right?
What I'd love to do, Kavita, is have you walk through maybe a case study of, I don't know how many land development deals that you've done, but maybe kind of walk through the case study, give us an example as to, you know, the opportunity, you know, what the time frame looked like to get that property to go through the entitlement process, and then what the potential exit, or if it already did exit, what, you know, what's it exit for? What's the projected exit cost? Who's it going to? Who's the end user of that piece of property? Just again, the basics here, and I want you to talk to it as though we don't know the process from anything. Like, literally, we know nothing about the entitlement process, which I don't. I know the basics. I know very high-level basics, but, like, I've never gone through the land entitlement myself and know very little bit about that process.
Sure, happy to. So I haven't done a full disclaimer here. I haven't gone through a full cycle yet on land. I started most of the land development projects last year. So we haven't gone full cycle on anything, but I'll just give you an idea of the process and why and how we add value to the land, right? So let's say we bought this property or piece of land, which is agricultural zone, like ag yep. land, for, let's say, $2 a square foot, right? Now, we decide, okay, this piece of land has, it's large enough that we can parcel it out into different uses. So let's say I see it has a frontage of a main street. So that frontage could be retail, right? Most likely it'll be retail because now you have a big street access which retail needs. Now, there could be a portion of it which would be parceled into a multifamily portion. So let's say we bought 133 or 130 piece of acre of land. Now we have different uses set aside or come up with a site plan, which says, okay, 20 acres, 15, 20 acres, multifamily, this 13 acres in the front, which has the frontage, will be our retail. At the back will be single family lots. Each lot will be 40 foot wide. And then there are X number of lots that we can build into this. So we come up, we engage an engineering firm, and then we also engage architects. So different pieces are involved. Okay, so the three main ways you can do land, right? One is land banking. So you buy land, you hold land, and you just wait for the market to appreciate. So that's one strategy. Land entitlement is the second strategy, where you take ag land and come up with a site plan and get all the approvals and zoning and planning in place with the county or the city or maybe both authorities. So everybody who has the jurisdiction over that piece of land has to write off and sign off and say, okay, now this property is approved or this piece of land is approved for these three different uses or whatever use mm-hmm. you decide your plan is going to say. So that whole process, at least depending on which authority you're dealing with, can take anywhere from, let's say, 12 months to 24 months, 6 months at the very least, because you have to go through the process. So we have an engineering firm we engage. They'll look at the easements. They'll look at detentions we need for the land. They'll do environmental assessments of the land. They'll do geotech assessments. There's a whole bunch of little things involved before we can take land and make it a buildable piece of land, right? Like, or what we call shovel ready. So the first phase is the entitlement phase. The second phase is the horizontal development. And then the third phase is actually the vertical development where people actually see something happening. So before that, we're just moving dirt around in the second phase. In the first phase, we don't do anything, like meaning we don't even touch that piece of land. It's all about approvals. So the second phase is horizontal development. We build the roads, we put down the utilities, and we actually make it buildable only after the second phase for vertical construction.
Got it. And so I was going to ask real quick, the current project that you're working on, what stage do you intend to take it to before you look to exit out of it? Are you going to take it to that horizontal stage?
So since we don't want to engage, so I talked about the velocity of money, right? So we don't want to engage investor capital for too long when we are talking about velocity, right? We want to deliver high IRRs and move investor capital quickly. So what we found is, let's say I go through just the first phase, I could potentially, let's say, buy a piece of land at $2, $3 a square foot and sell it between $6 and $10 a square foot. And again, all of these numbers are very location dependent. I'm just putting some number out there. So retail might sell higher per square foot than single family lots might sell, right? But all of this is only ready after the second phase. But the first phase, we have already increased the value of that land per square foot from raw land, right? And the buildable portion, we might keep the investors only for phase one and say, okay, we are done. At this point, I can parcel out and say, I'm going to just sell the retail portion and they might do their own horizontal development. Or I might tell the investors, hey, you have the first right of refusal to go into the second phase with us, which will tie up your capital a little bit longer. So you can decide to pull out your profits at this point and move just the capital over. So we want to give people options and not tie up their money for too long because there's no real cash flow in the game.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And so really the biggest risk on the front side of this is, I guess one would be the, you know, there's a good amount of upfront costs associated, pursuit costs associated with the first phase of this land entitlement process. And again, just the timeliness associated with whatever municipality or regulatory agencies that you might be dealing with regards to approvals, and the chances that, I guess there is that chance that ultimately you might not be able to, you might not get the exact approvals that you were hoping for, right? Like you do your best work with an engineering firm that has a really good idea about what can and what can't be done in this particular municipality, but like there's never ever a guarantee,
right,
until it's actually stamped, right?
Yeah. One of the things we do to mitigate some of those risks are we usually have about 60 to 90 day feasibility before we buy the piece of land, right? So during the feasibility, we are already engaging the city to see, okay, what is it that the city wants to do or the county wants to do, depending. Like there are some piece of land where we don't even have to deal with the city. Right. So once we get a fair idea, what I found is that as long as we are in alignment with what the city wants for that piece of land, it becomes a lot smoother. Of course, there's always a give and take. So like one piece of land, we plan 98 units to go on, like a BTR. And then when we're going through the process, we discovered, oh, we can't do this, we can't do that, we need easements here. We ended up with 95. So some cases I was telling you about that BTR we're doing where we started with like, hey, we'll do single family homes and we can get 150 of them. Now we are like, oh, wait a minute, that area grew. Now we can go duplex or quadplex even. Our density can be like 198 instead of 150. So all those are things which are in flux, which are not very well known. But what I think helps when you're working with land is, one, have a partner or have someone on the development side that is very tied into the cities and counties that you're working with. they already know people out there. They know how the system works. And it's all about who you know, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then already have an idea of what the city really wants out of you from that piece of land. Mm-hmm. Right? At the end of the day, every city wants to grow, wants to get more tax dollars in. As long as you support them with that goal, they're happy.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. And so, well, that's exciting, very exciting. I know that you'd also mentioned, during that, the conversation about the land entitlement and development process, the BTR, the build to rent model, which is absolutely booming, right?
Sure. I think it's a buzzword, right?
Yeah. No, it is, but I think it's here to stay. And so, you'd mentioned your partner. I know your partner that you're working on with that, and great guy. And I guess my question would be, there's ultimately two different models with the build to rent strategy as well. Assuming that you're actually going to go vertical with the development, either way, you're either going to build it with the intent of selling it off to one of the many large institutional buyers out there right now that are buying as much as they potentially can, or it's going to be to recapitalize it once it's built and ultimately look to get investor capital back, either the majority or all of it, and then look to hold that asset long term. What is the strategy with your couple different build to rent model projects?
So yeah, it depends on the particular one. So one, we tried an interesting strategy. We pre-sold some of these duplexes, and we said, okay, you put down X dollars right now, then you put down Y dollars later, and your total cost for buying it is X plus Y, but it's set in stone right now. So you get a product at the end of it, which you can call your own. So we tried that, where we only pre-sold half the units that we were building. The other half will be run as a BTR community.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we tried that model, and honestly, I don't like that model.
I wonder if there's challenges. No, I get it. I mean, you're trying to lower your basis, right? So that makes a ton of sense. But I'm wondering, from a long-term debt strategy, if that fractured aspect of it now affects what type of debt you can ultimately get. Because I know that, in entire build-to-rent communities, I mentioned that we're looking at a project now that's a townhome, a really high-end townhome build-to-rent community in Phoenix that, Fannie and Freddie absolutely play in that space. But I didn't go as far as actually asking the question whether or not they would still have an interest if it ended up being a fractured type of development. Do you know any details on that as to what type of debt you would or wouldn't be able to get, assuming it's fractured?
We haven't gone that far. We've gotten through the entitlement phase on that project, and right now we are going to start horizontal development in a few months. So I think that's TBD. One of the reasons we did that, though, if you think about it, is we were thinking we'll sell the rest to retail initially. We didn't have this plan of doing BTRs. But now that we're looking at the market, we're like, we'll be fine just selling half of them and then holding the rest as our portfolio. We don't even have to sell it to someone, right? Yeah. So that's sort of been evolving. So we'll see how the market is. If there's a strategy to just sell it to retail buyers, we'll do it. If the location is great. So we have multiple exit strategies. So we'll evaluate it based on what the market's doing at the time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think really the biggest risk outside of rate increases are really the rising construction costs. And it's, in a development project such as this, is really, how do you model that out given the volatility that we've had and currently are having, with cost of goods? And so that's a tough one. I'm not sure anyone has a real answer to that question either, but you do the best you can, I guess, right?
I think the upside to that is the rents in a market like Austin, the rents and the property prices are going up significantly. So I think that cost of construction as well as the cost of labor going up is kind of baked in right now at this point.
I agree, but that's agreed. And every market's a little different. At some point, a ceiling does get hit. We surely don't know where that is at present, but at some point, a ceiling does get hit. So of all the different types of projects you've got going on at present time, what would you say you're most excited about and why? And that's not necessarily saying like, I like multifamily more than build to rent or build to rent more than senior care or what have you. And so, but like just generally speaking, what project are you most excited about at present time?
I think right now the land entitlement projects, to me, they're just, I mean, I know it seems risky, but I feel like once we've gotten a lot of these in place and we have very good connections in the with the county, the cities, I feel like those will be quick equity growth projects for us. So I'm excited about it from the quick turnaround, and I'm excited to see what it actually produces right now, to see on the back end. It's a quick win, right? I'm going to take quick wins right now. Mm-hmm. And long term, I think I'm very excited about senior living. I just want to be in that space, and I feel like it's what multifamily was 10 years ago. We still have a lot of run up to do in that space. So I think that's a place I want to hang my hat, you know?
Yeah. You know, I agree with you. I mean, I love the senior care space. I would say that it's much more of a business play than a real estate play. There's obviously a real estate component to it. And so while a spot, you know, finding a good sponsor with a good track record is incredibly important in any asset class that you're going to invest in, I think even more so is the case in senior care facilities. And so I guess maybe that is another question I should ask, is that being that you've worked with a lot of different sponsors now in a co-GP type arrangement, what has worked for you as far as identifying, you know, the better sponsors over maybe the less desirable ones? And again, I think that the other part of that I want to layer into that question is, you know, it seems a lot of sponsors that are out there nowadays are like post 2008, right? Like they kind of got their start post 2008, and I don't hold that against anybody, but they've been in this upcycle for the entirety of the time. So are you looking for sponsors that started prior to 2008, or is there another system or process that you have in place to really determine, I guess not just the viability, but just the strength of that sponsor, given that they might not have an incredibly long track record over multiple market cycles.
Right. Well, I think it's hard to find a lot of people with multiple market cycle experience if I were to kind of pigeonhole myself there.
Yeah, fair enough. That's a good point.
I do want to see, I think for me, generally, just being aligned in our like values, as far as how we are very investor focused, just integrity as a person. I think at the end of the day, I really want to know that they will do the right thing when shit hits the fan.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I can't really say, oh, you have to have prior to 2008 experience. If they do, that's great. But I have also, I don't have it either, right? So I think one of the things is how you handle, what is your worst deal, right? What is your worst deal? How did you handle and navigate that deal? And how did you communicate with people? I think that's a big piece of the puzzle for me, is just transparency with investors and telling them, hey, this is what's going on. You know, I don't care if it's a good news or bad news. I just want to communicate what it is. Yep. And I feel like that is really what investors want to hear, is that, hey, just tell me what's going on. Not communicating is like the worst thing in a sponsor.
I agree. Absolutely agree with you. Well, Kavitha, it's been a lot of fun having you here. Really appreciate you coming on the show. For those that want to learn more about you and your company, what you have going on, where's the best place for them to find you?
A couple of places. They can go to my website, cherrystreetinvestments.com, all spelled out, Cherry and Street. I have a YouTube channel that I do a lot of investor education. That's something I spend a lot of time on, doing webinars and short videos. It's Cherry Street Investor Education on YouTube. So please feel free to go there, subscribe to my channel. I don't mind a few more subscribers. You can find me there. I'm also on LinkedIn. So a lot of places.
All righty. Well, thanks again, Kavitha. It's been a lot of fun having you here.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
All righty, guys. That's all we have for this week's show. So until we meet again next week, this is your host, Kevin Bupp, wishing you huge success. Take care.
Congratulations. Now you've got more of the best tricks of the trade in building massive amounts of passive income from real estate. For more amazing resources, visit realestateinvestingforcashflow.com. And we'll see you next Monday morning.